This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle here with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. How about yourself?
Doing okay. All right. So we are going to talk today about neoteny. Why do women sleep with men who don't love them? We are going to be talking about asexuality. And if we can get to it, we're going to be talking about genetics and time in the womb and how that can, if that will shape our personalities. So let's just get started. Dr. Lyle, you ready?
Very good.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, can you please talk about what neoteny is? How are neoteny and female attractiveness related? Why does this work? Why is esteem so important to human beings? And if the big five and intelligence are so important to knowing who a person really is, how does a person figure out what the other person is without them taking a big five test?
Okay. All right. The first issue is about neoteny. And what this is, as far as humans are concerned, is it's the observation that human beings look like they are juveniles. In other words, they have characteristics that make them look young even as they're aging. And there's several characteristics in biology where this is true, where the nature of the shape of faces in primates and the size of the head relative to the body. These are the fact that the body becomes hairless, all these sorts of things. And there's been quite a number of explanations over the years for why different biologists have thought that this was true. My favorite explanation is the notion that this is probably a characteristic probably fairly recently in evolution, maybe the last 100,000 or so years, that sexual selection by males looking to mate with younger females has driven female characteristics to look youthful. And so, and even possibly even youthful-like behaviors, giggling, higher voices, all sorts of things that could be related to youth cues. Actually, the expenditure of energy and excitement and emotional excitement, etc. So this would come about in a species with menopause where women would be competing, would potentially be heading to a cliff where they would no longer be able to keep mates around for resources, et cetera, if the mates were to figure out that they were no longer fertile. And so if you could essentially bluff the males into thinking that you were still fertile, there would be essentially evolutionary pressure to evidence cues both physically and behaviorally that would suggest that you are still youthful. So I forget who the chief author of this was, but I think I remember seeing this somewhere in Miller's writing somewhere. It made a great deal of sense to me, and I can remember even quite frankly, my mother at 84 years old most definitely evidences childlike, girlish behavioral characteristics. And that completely different than my father, you know. So my father never evidenced such things. My mother always has, literally her whole life. And that it would look like this is probably it probably has its roots in sexual selection, probably behind that competitive problem. So the that is incidentally there's other times in evolution that are important where creatures are being selected for youthful characteristics, most particularly in human domestication of animals. So the domestication of animals, people are picking up on juvenile-like neoteny characteristics in individuals, individual Arctic wolves and individual cats and so on and so forth. And you're looking for the animals that look like they are juveniles because juvenile animals are friendlier. And the and probably it's also true that human beings throughout the last 100,000 years of increased trade have essentially selected each other in trade relations for neoteny characteristics. In other words, juvenile-like characteristics, even in males, where they are less rugged, less fierce, therefore more cooperative, and therefore more useful as trade partners. So it's hypothesized that human beings have effectively domesticated animals, and the first animal that they probably domesticated was themselves through trade relations and also even man-woman relationships have probably had such a high level of cooperation in their activities, have probably been selected for high degrees of cooperation, which are also related then to not being quite so fierce and so, quote, adult. So anyway, I think that's where the neoteny in humans ultimately comes from. Probably the biggest vector in this has been men selecting for females that are still evidencing youth cues. So that's probably why we have those. But in addition, we have probably selected each other more broadly for some of these characteristics across the last 100,000 years, where trade looks to have become a much, much bigger force in human evolution. I say this because my understanding is that the skulls of humans have become increasingly thin in the last 100,000 years, maybe even more so in the last 50. And that is a neoteny characteristic, is the thinner skulls. All right. Now, next wow. question was about esteem, okay? So
well, let me ask you about the neoteny again.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
My thinking was do when the women who are menopausal and they're seeking to bluff the male, do they succeed in this, or is this just something that got weeded out?
Oh no, I'm sure they did and do. In other words, this is not, you know, obviously this is biological bluffing. The female isn't consciously attempting to do anything of the kind, but the male's, part of the male's job is to figure out whether the female is out of eggs, and part of the female's job is to bluff the male into thinking that she's still got some. And so notice, for example, it's no accident, and it's a worldwide phenomenon, that women are extremely disturbed about their aging cues. So, you know, this is not something that happened with modern cosmetic surgery and oil of Olay, for God's sakes. This has been going on forever. The women know that they are under threat for having mates leave them for younger females, and therefore there goes some of the child raising help and protection and provision. So that is an obvious thing. I forget where else I was going with this. The females are not, so they can do some conscious bluffing because it's such a major motivational issue. They're actually thinking it through, for God's sakes, and it arrives in real live English or French or Spanish inside of people's heads, like, ooh, I got to worry about my beauty and my looks and my youth and my gray hair and everything else under the sun, particularly my wrinkles. But unconsciously, the biology, both in terms of the brain and in terms of physical cues, physical characteristics, is looking to try to bluff the male out of probably what is an important few years of protection and provision. And so this has been part of an evolutionary arms race between males' detection abilities versus females' bluffing abilities, and the truth winds up somewhere in the middle. So you're going to find probably males are going to find women still sexually attractive past their fertility, and yet wouldn't at some point when they start to see that they're convinced that there is no fertility, then the attraction is going to probably drop off quite a bit and quite precipitously, but it's going to be across a time frame for each individual female and each individual male. It is notable that males are much more sensitive to aging cues than females are. That is no accident. So males are more accurate at detecting ages of females than females are detecting ages of males or females, I believe. So males have razor sharp eyes looking for aging cues in a way that, strangely enough, females don't. Similarly and interestingly, and I don't know why for sure, but females' sense of smell is much better than males' sense of smell. There could be many reasons for that, but one of those reasons could be sniffing whether males have been hugging and having sex with other females, whether they can pick up other scents. That wouldn't surprise me a bit if that was a significant force. I don't know that it is, but it could be, and it would be, you know, reasonable that that would be a characteristic females could evolve.
That reminds me about a story that I will not share on air, but
but you've lived a much more interesting life in your short years. Go ahead. All right. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting that the counterpart for males is that they're trying to bluff the female in casual mating strategy, whereas the female's trying to bluff the male into envisioning. And it's just fascinating to me.
Just to let you know, on my end, your audio is very choppy. But I did get the gist of what you're saying. In other words, this is exactly how evolution really works. Males and females are sitting in an interesting problem that exists throughout all kinds of relationships that humans have with each other, and that is that they sit with a cooperative problem, and they have a competitive problem, and so they are sitting in a complex game of competition and cooperation. And so in that game, there's all kinds of deception as well as honest cooperation that's going on. So sometimes, you know, the left hand has one game going and the right hand has another. And that's the name of the game across evolutionary time. All right, let's look at esteem. Yeah, esteem is issue. Why is it so important to humans? Actually, it's really the most important thing that there is to humans. So let's look at why this is. The reason is that if we break this down from the most fundamental level in biology, the job of an organism is to reproduce its DNA, which means it has two big problems that it's trying to solve. One problem we're going to call it survival, and the other problem we're going to call reproduction. Now, both of those things are actually simply derivatives of the same problem, which is what we're going to call the problem of gene survival. So the real purpose of the organism is for the genes that are within it to copy themselves and survive as copies into the next generation. That is the task of the organism. So gene survival is the ultimate purpose of the organism's design, and in order to get that done, the organism needs to survive and reproduce. So under those two big monster headings of survive and reproduce, what the creature needs to do is it needs to solve what we're going to call subproblems. So the subproblems of survival and reproduction, if we look inside of them, they all have to do with social relations issues. Now, this is where the outstanding humanist in the 20th century, Abraham Maslow, really did not understand the architecture of human motivation. He couldn't have, and we couldn't have expected him to. He was writing well ahead of evolutionary theory. The Maslow, had this concept of a hierarchy of needs. He's trying to figure out, what the needs are of human beings and how they work and so on and so forth. All very good and appropriate for him to try to understand this. And what he had in his list was he had things like the basic needs like food and shelter, et cetera, and safety. And then up from there, he had some other needs. I forget what they were. And then in the middle somewhere, he had like what he called esteem needs for belongingness. And then above that, it was like love or something. And then above that was what he called self-actualization, where, the person is sort of above all the fray of what normal humans are going for. And they're sort of going for something deep and meaningful and completely independent of anything else other than their own, actualizing their own potential. All right. All good, interesting, worthy effort for someone who's trying to figure out human motivation outside the context of human biology, which is basically impossible. So let's look at through the heart of where this is going to be a problem, that we start right away with basic needs, food and shelter and safety. Those things are not independent of social relationships. In fact, they are entirely dependent on social relationships. Human beings do not live as hermits. Okay, they don't. They live in groups. And those groups require cooperation, very intensive cooperation, in the teeth of conflicts of interest, i.e., I want to sleep with your girlfriend, you want to sleep with my girlfriend, and I want to eat your food, and you want to eat my food. Okay, so we've got nothing but conflicts of interest here. And so human beings have to cooperate, and they have to be known to be essentially more benefit than they are cost in terms of the interaction with the other people and living side by side with them. So people are running cost-benefit analysis on whether or not to have relationships with other people in the three chief domains that human beings trade their time and energy, which are mating, friendship, and trade. And so what esteem is esteem is the process by which we as individuals judge other individuals, and we judge them, we rate them as to how valuable or how valuable we find them, which is what esteem is. And so to ask the question, why is esteem so critical in human life? The answer is it's critical for everything. It is the most in the Stone Age, it's the most important feature that will determine your ability to survive. And it is the most important feature that will determine your ability to reproduce. So are there other features of your life that are important? Yes, like how cold is it? If we're all hungry, how much meat do you have in your bones, et cetera. Like there are other features of life that are important to human beings. But the most central feature that determines your survival and reproductive success is the esteem that you hold. And it's the esteem that other people have conferred upon you by virtue of your advertisement of the benefits that you would bring to relationships. So if you're beautiful, you bring a lot of benefits, and therefore you are esteemed more than someone who is less beautiful, and you get those cues from other people. And those cues are critical in helping determine whether you will survive or not. Don't even think about asking the question, who gets saved, the less attractive person or the more attractive person? If we got somebody in the boat and it's sinking, and who are we going to grab? All right, this is not difficult. This gets actually increasingly brutal when you realize, for example, the shopping cart studies that have shown that unattractive children are not monitored nearly as closely as attractive children in a grocery store. So the parents let them roam far and wide, and they're much more likely to get lost in the grocery store and not know where their parents are, because attractive parents are not doing that. They're keeping very close track of those children. The ostensibly because
the
children are more
in
the valuable.
Store growing up.
What's that?
I got lost a lot. I lost my mom a lot of times. My sisters, however, my parents didn't lose sight of them very often.
No, but you were expendable. All right. So that is why esteem is so central to human nature and human happiness, and that's why essentially human happiness is largely but not completely dependent on the nature of the flow of esteem coming from outside people into your nervous system, or what I call esteem signals. All right. Now let's look at last question this person had was about if the big five are so important in romance, for example, how do you figure out who the other person is without them taking a test? Well, you're actually designed by nature to figure this out. The big five, you know, may have been consciously discovered in the last few decades, but they have been understood forever. And so you're designed by nature to be looking at these characteristics, not only looking at them, but also displaying them to best affect yourself. You're simply built this way. And so the you can't miss somebody's intelligence. That's going to hit you over the head without too much interaction. The other big five characteristics, openness to experience, conscientiousness, how agreeable they are, how outgoing they are, how emotionally stable they are. These things are actually, that's called getting to know somebody. And I would say that this is mostly to be played by feel, with a couple exceptions. And I think that there are two exceptions that are worth noting and underlining in your own mind, particularly depending upon who you are and what your motivations are in the mating arena. If you're a male who is pursuing either casual mating or pair bond at any given time, then you don't worry about it. You're just deciding whether or not you're physically attracted to the person and whether the effort of trying to get to score is worth the trouble, and you're testing the feedback, et cetera, et cetera. It's not essential that you slice and dice and try to make sure that you are sort of hanging out with a person that's worthy of your character. If you're a female, however, you're likely to be in different circumstances, and that is that you are probably feeling the pinch of time and energy with respect to the problem of trying to find an outstanding mate. And so if that is in fact your situation, then you would like very much to be able to have, as Jeffrey Miller would say, to have their big five profile tattooed on their forehead. So that would be a nice thing to have, okay? Now, so the things that are where people are going to likely they're going to try to hide their liabilities. You cannot hide liabilities in your intelligence. There's just nowhere to hide. Casual conversation starts dragging that out of people at a very rapid rate. The fact that that's true can tell you that intelligence has reigned supreme as an absolutely critical variable in trying to assess mates. If that were not true, you wouldn't be so good at figuring it out. So that's one thing. These other characteristics are less important, but they're also still very important. And so I would say the two that my eyes are most sharpened for are conscientiousness and agreeableness. In the longer term, emotional stability is also going to become important. So that may show itself over time and probably will in not too much time. So conscientiousness and agreeableness, though, are important to when you're trying to find partners who are actually really good long-term partners. So we want people that we're looking for essentially stability in employment, stability in relationships, non-complaining of previous relationships, for example. Somebody that's complaining about a lot about previous relationships is pretty low conscientiousness in general, okay, or disagreeable, or both. Now, those aren't set in stone. I'm just telling you that those are cues. So conscientiousness and also agreeableness, just in casual conversation and also in the very slight possible disagreements that come up in early conversations, disagreeable people have no problem contradicting you. And so whenever I see that, which I occasionally will, it's a glaring red flag. More agreeable people have the discipline to, even when they disagree with you, they don't show it, okay? And they're very careful to feather any disagreements in a web of, this is what I call the octopus strategy. They will put ink all over the water, and you can't tell quite what they think because they're not wanting to agree with you, but they don't want to disagree with you. Now, disagreeable people won't do that. That doesn't make them bad people. Just be warned that they're disagreeable. And the more they contradict other people and things and insist that everybody else is wrong about everything, then the more complaining that they do, the more disagreeable they are. So these are sort of the general guidelines. Look for contradictions. Look for disagreement in anything with respect to where are we going to meet, when would you like to meet, et cetera. Agreeable people particularly are going to bend over backwards to make sure that they are signaling that they're pleasant and agreeable to deal with. Okay, that doesn't mean if anybody says, no, I can't meet then, I could meet then. No, I don't want that. No, I really don't like Greek food. Okay, quite frankly, if someone said to me, I really like steak and fish, you know, can we go there? I'd be like, sure. Okay, now it'd be a little odd for somebody to put that out there. So when I ask somebody what they'd like to eat, I usually offer about three different things, and whatever they choose, I'm agreeing to it. But the willingness to display contrary opinion and contradiction, and as well as lifetime evidence of instability in employment, relationships, school, everything under the sun, these are not hallmarks in any given case of lower conscientiousness, for example, but they start to tell a story. The person's life, as you gently listen to their stories and listen to their life story, it should be relatively, you should be able to understand it. It should integrate into a picture that makes sense. If it doesn't, then somebody is hiding the time when they spent in county jail. We're skipping that. It's like a resume with a big thing missing. So when I'm speaking with people, I just have them tell me a story, and that's what I'll say. I'll say, hey, well, tell me a story. How did you come to San Francisco? What happened? And I just want them to roll out and tell me the story of their life, and then I will gently cross-examine and ask, oh, what did you do then, and then what happened then? And we want to hear the openness of telling a story that makes sense. So, no, we don't need a test. We need a story. And we can get that story if we're just patient and pleasant and we ask questions and we, for God's sake, don't contradict them. If you're a difficult human and you feel like contradicting, just bite your lip. You'll live. All right. Let's go on to something different. All right.
Sounds good. I was going to ask you, what can you infer about somebody who brings the BF10 survey to the first date and insists that their date fills it out before they start?
Oh my God, that's hilarious! That is a hyper conscientious. That's like an OCD kind of characteristic, and highly entertaining. All right.
Next question, dear Dr. Sure. Lau. This is about, why do women stay with men that do not love them?
Ah, okay. Well, let's start the question far more broadly, and that is, why does anybody do anything? And the reason why anybody does anything is that they're running cost-benefit analyses. And so why a woman stays with a man, why she leaves a man, you know, et cetera, why she's been with a man as opposed to with a woman, like, this is nothing other than cost-benefit analysis. And so the situation here that's probably being asked is why would a woman stay with someone? Stay probably meaning long term, years. So we're talking about with a man that doesn't love them. Obviously, we're not talking about staying with a guy for a few weeks or a few months or even a year probably. We're probably talking about the consternation that someone has as they observe themselves staying in a very long-term relationship and spending a great amount of their lives with someone who, quote, doesn't love them. Now, this is because the reason they would do that is because there's going to be forces on both sides of the equation. Whenever you're trying to understand behavior, you have to understand that that behavior is nothing really other than vector analysis. It's just about different forces pushing each other in opponent directions, and the behavior that you observe is essentially some kind of fancy summation process that goes on. So let's look at why women stay with men. They stay with men because they've got kids with them and they worry about the status for the kids coming from a broken home or having to say that their parents are divorced, or it could reduce their kids' potential mating cachet in their particular village if their parents were divorced. Or they're worried about that if they stay together, then essentially the main finances as well as all protection and provision efforts from the male are going to be directed at her children, as opposed to if they break up and they officially break up and get through that process, that man may shack up with somebody new that either has kids of her own or that he may create new children, at which point resources are going to be directed away from our woman's children to potential other children. So that's a problem. Time, effort, and energy for a given standard of living, just straight money. So the modern world has the disadvantage, has the great advantage of wealth, where we get to enjoy houses that were built 100 years ago or 20 years ago, et cetera. So the standard of living of a modern human in a modern westernized society is phenomenal compared to where things were 100 years ago, much less 100,000 years ago. And so with money on the scene or resources or wealth on the scene, you can better believe that this is going to make a big impact on people's decision making. You know, which would you rather do? Stay in a relationship where the guy's not very into you and he's into other people and you're just having to deal with this knowledge. Or you could leave and then go work on the factory floor somewhere, or you can stay and not have to work on the factory floor. You can work in a nice gift shop for 15 hours a week and have a nice little pleasant time talking about, I don't know, little tchotchkes that people buy. Okay? So this is a decision that could be very important to any woman or anybody else that is involved in a situation where money is a factor. Now, status in the broader community is also another resource. And we talked about how human beings' esteem in their village is really front and center when it comes to their happiness and their survival and reproductive success. And so that echoing through the ages is still a concern that is true. And so to be somebody's wife who is successful, stable, whatever it is, looks fine, looks like everything's fine, looks like I'm fine because I'm in a relationship, looks like I'm fine because I'm married, looks like I'm fine because I'm in a nice house, everything looks fine. Okay? Now, one thing isn't fine, which is the woman's not getting romantic esteem cues from her mate. And so that's an open sore and an open circuit that is not being anywhere near satisfied. And if she really is into the guy or really likes the guy, she's being rejected. That's even harder. But the giving up status by openly admitting that one is not actually the apple of one's mate's eye, that's not an easy, that's a potentially significant sacrifice depending upon who that individual is and her circumstances. Finally, those males and females, that man and that woman, may have a very genuine friendship. And so there could be a lot of value and the relationship even as a friendship, but it's but somewhat heartbreaking that that relationship is not a romantic relationship. And both parties may be hesitant to break that relationship up just because there is so much friendship goodwill. Yeah, in human beings, mates are not just mates. They are mates, they are friends, and they are also very often trading partners. And so it is the most complex set of relationships that you will find in the animal kingdom. So it is no surprise that at one point in time, a person could qualify to be a mate, but at a later time, they no longer qualify to be a mate, but they do qualify to be a friend. And that often happens in these situations. So to give away potentially a very good friend in some sort of publicly humiliating, acrimonious situation and then start fighting with your best friend over the stored wealth, this is a problem. And sometimes people aren't willing to do it. So there are a complex array of issues that can be visiting any specific woman's head when it comes to why she should or shouldn't go. And every situation is different. And these are all nuanced decisions. And so, therefore, I'm never surprised when women stay in situations where, from my personal perspective, from my personal psychology, I look at it and say, I wouldn't stay. But I'm not a female, and I'm not in her circumstances. And so, therefore, I'm in no position to judge whether my assessment of what the best decision is in fact the best decision. There's another factor, and that is that women are often more motivated to leave when they believe they've got substantial market value. And so there's a knocking at the door as she arrives up towards but before menopause, where it's like, if you're going to leave, you better do it. You better do it now. And a lot of times, if she does not leave and the relationship survives past that point, a lot of times there's a sense of, well, what the hell, what's the point now? And that is another factor that often seems to transpire. That if we arrive at 50 or 55, it's like, what are we thinking now? And so you will see a lot of people stay at that point, even if it turns out that the most optimal solution that they can arrive at is to some degree, live separate lives under one roof. So that is a long, convoluted answer to a specific question that actually has more general principles involved. And those general principles that we can revisit again and again in the analysis of any human dilemma, which is that human beings are running complex cost-benefit analyses, and there are usually multiple factors involved that are highly individual to that, to that specific person and situation. And so, a lot of times the values are not. You can name the same 10 values, but everybody's vector force on each of those values is a little bit different. And so that's why some people will stay and some people will leave.
Fascinating. That's just fascinating. All right.
We're going to get
to one last question.
Okay.
That's a two-part question. It's like they're not completely related, but we're going to give it a shot anyway. So,
yes.
Dear Dr. Lyle, I noticed that most of the content of the podcast is about mating strategies. I identify as asexual. Asexual is defined as a person who doesn't experience sexual attraction to anyone at all and may even be repulsed by sex. I find all the content about the mating strategies both interesting but also somewhat unrelatable. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on asexuality, and if it turns out it is something biological that people cannot change about themselves, what other ways can you fire up moods of happiness circuits, as they are missing out on a very significant mating moods of happiness circuits? Second question is, should people try?
Yeah, okay.
I guess we can go to the first one first.
Yeah, let's go to the first one. Let's see where this takes us. The the first thing that I would say about asexuality is that I would look at this as nothing other than on a bell curve. So we're going to see in the middle of the bell curve, we're going to see people, the typical, and we would have two separate bell curves that would overlap, but they would be somewhat shifted, with the male brain having more sexual thoughts and more steam behind it than the female brain on average. So think of two bell curves. A female bell curve is the first one, and then we shift to the right, and the male bell curve is shifted. So there are a twin pair of bell curves overlapping, where the males, the mean of the male bell curve is shifted to the right of the female mean. And the x-axis is we go from very low sexual impulses to very high sexual impulses on the right side of the x-axis. So what this is that there's individual variation here, as you would expect all over biology with respect to all characteristics. So, of course, there's going to be some people, more females than males, probably considerably more females than males, will have very few sexual impulses. That's just how it works. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a biological variant. In the same way that there will be people who are unbelievably hypersexual. And they too, you know, God bless them, I'm sure they've got a diagnosis in the DSM, okay? But the truth of the matter is, this is just them. This is their psychology. And that's how they're built. And there's nothing wrong with it, quote, in quotes. It is just who it is that they are. So there's nothing wrong with an asexual person or a hypersexual person. These are just genetic variations. We tend to look somewhere in the middle of the bell curve and see that people are seemingly, quote, normal. But the degree of variance in normal people is pretty extreme on this dimension. You see actually quite significant differences in males and females on this dimension. So in some book back there, is probably The Evolution of Desire by Buss, or might have been a later work, where it's been well documented that females, this will startle many people that are listening, but it won't startle a whole bunch of other people that are listening. If you were to draw a bell curve of the female sexual thoughts during a month of a fertile female, you will find that for the first third of the month when they are not fertile, the typical human female has almost no sexual thoughts going through her head. You will then see a dramatic rise as soon as she has released an egg, and you will see that it will actually peak at the moment where she is most fertile. It will then start to decline in a bell-shaped fashion. And then by the time the egg is no longer fertile, the female is once again in the last third of her cycle, she is now not having any sexual thoughts. That is typical. Now, I have met, for no useful outcome of my own, I have met females for whom that is not true. So I have met females who have a lot of sexual thoughts all the time. And they don't even, you know, they either do or don't notice that they are more sexually inclined, you know, when they are fertile. But they are hot all the time, and that's just how they're built. I have met other females who literally just don't ever have a sexual thought in their head, never occurs to them. And they may go months before they have a sexual thought in their head. So this is an extraordinary variation that is much, much wider than you will see in males. So males, as you can expect, most males are having sexual thoughts. It is nothing like the tameness that you'll typically see in an average female. So I don't see anything wrong with asexuality at all, not even the slightest. I see it as a normal biological variation. I see it more commonly in females than males, probably by several factors. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a factor of 5 or 10 or 15 to 1. Now, what do we do about what this means about life and happiness, et cetera? Nothing. I am a person who does not like noisy parties, drinking, and et cetera, forget it. Never going to drag me there, okay? So I don't have the capacity to enjoy that scene. It's not in me. I am no way extroverted enough to handle and be comfortable in that setting. So am I missing out on life? No, I'm not. It's that that type of stimulation is not able to activate moods of happiness inside my head. The fact that it activates moods of happiness inside of other people's heads is interesting, and it's somewhat entertaining, but it is not relevant, okay? And so the what we're really talking about here is the concept of identity, and that is that you, each person, has their own unique psychological identity. And that identity is a set of characteristics that, although it overlaps with other people in many areas, is in fact, as a total configuration, it's unique. And so your identity is important for you to understand and to map it as well as you can, because you're trying to figure out what kinds of circumstances cause the moods of happiness to be activated inside my nervous system. It really isn't important what causes other people to have moods of happiness. I couldn't care less, okay? So, you know, some guy likes to mate with his dog. I couldn't care less. It's not interesting to me. Believe it or not, I had a criminal case where that was happening. But the point is that, you know, somebody tells me, I don't know, Alan was all excited about chamoyas, you know. He said, oh, they're the greatest thing. They're better than any dessert, Doug. You just got to wait till you eat a chamoya. Well, I ate one.
Probably didn't eat a good one.
I've eaten one chamoya dutifully in my entire life, all right? That's the last chamoya I'm going to eat. My identity is different than my good friend Alan Goldhammer's. Fair enough, all right? So if you are asexual, that means your identity is different in that area than a lot of other people. We don't care. What we care about is that your time and energy then be directed towards the things that do activate your moods of happiness, and those could be, you know, they're likely to be as varied as the human landscape. So our job in this life is to figure out, really, and it's a very interesting question, and it's one that to me is so obvious, and yet when I've sometimes explained this to people, sometimes older people, sometimes a 68-year-old lady sitting in my office with her mouth open that never considered that this is one of the most important questions in life, which is, what makes me happy? What do I like to do? What do I like to eat? Where do I find excitement? What's enjoyable to me? Okay? And people will say, well, wait. You know, isn't it you shouldn't be serving others? Doesn't that sound selfish? And to my answer is, of course it's selfish, which is exactly what it should be. One of the most important things that you can attempt to discover in this life is, what am I like? What do I like? You know, what sorts of things cause me to be happy? And that can change. You can change and grow, and something that you were excited about before becomes boring. That can happen, and then we move on. As your identity has shifted and you now have new things that need to be encountered and experienced in order to activate the moods of happiness. I look at this life as a complex video game where our job is to score happiness points. And those points, doesn't mean this is cheesy or tacky in any way. A lot of those points have to do with figuring out how can I essentially get the most esteem by doing a really good job for the village. And so that is one of the ways that we get points. But it's not the only way we get points. We also get points from, I don't know, I like to watch LeBron James play basketball. That's a way that I get points. If somebody says, oh, but I could have been feeding the poor in my town instead of watching LeBron. Fair enough. You know, my conscience looks at me and the work that I do and the things that I do to help other people, and I feel square with my own conscience and my own identity because I'm not Mother Teresa. And my system says, no, I've done a good job there. Now it's time for me to sit back and watch somebody else do something well. So this is this is what we do, and we don't worry about the fact that we're different than other people. We embrace it, and our job is to not care about that aspect, but rather to try to figure out how am I unique and what can I do with my time and energy that brings me joy.
Wow, fascinating.
Gone. Where is it? Don't know. You're good. Nah. You're good, Doc. You're good. I'm going to begin to touch with you.
Dr. Lau, thank you so much. For people who want to learn more about Dr. Lau and maybe schedule a consult, it's esteemdynamics.com. Thank you, Dr. Lau, very much. We will go through the next set of questions next week. And if you'd like to send us a message, beatyourgenes@gmail.com. Dr. Lau, thank you very much. Really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure. We'll see y'all soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.